Welcome everyone to a new Bina term, a new Bina year. It's really good to see everyone. It's taken us a while after COVID, but we're filling up again, which is really good. And the topic this term is a very complex and broad topic, the topic of trauma. It's an important topic to look at, including exploring, as we always do, and as I always like to do, exploring the topic from contemporary sources in a contemporary context, but checking it, so to speak, and comparing it and understanding what does the ancient Jewish Torah sources have to say, which is something we always do in the context of those concepts that we find in the Talmud or the Torah being eternal truths. So we always need to make sure that we are in line with those philosophies and those ideas as believing Jews. But before we get into the topic, I want to just mention a couple of things. First of all, this series that we're going to do is going to go for 5 weeks until the 2nd of March. But then we're still going to keep going for 3 weeks. What I'm going to do this year a bit is do series and then do a couple of one-offs, just like one-off topics. So we'll do 3 weeks of one-off topics. If anyone has a suggestion of any issue you think I should address, please let me know. I'm always open to new things. I'm open to learning and exploring. So if it's a topic I haven't done before, that's great. That's even better. A second thing I just want to mention, perhaps just in extension from the series, my son and myself, Rabbi Levi and myself, are starting a new podcast, which will probably start next week, called The JP Show, JP being Jewish Perspective, where we're going to take a lot of the topics. Good, now we know we're doing the right PR there. Excellent, thank you. So we are going to take, we're going to have a discussion about some of the topics that we discuss on Thursday morning. It's not instead of Thursday morning. It'll just be a synopsis and maybe an extension. So if you're listening to these discussions, then that could enhance it. We'll put it on the WhatsApps and the broadcasts and the emails, so look out for it. Okay, so in the last few decades, the topic of trauma has become a very big topic. Understanding what it is, understanding its effects, and of course understanding the process and the journey of the healing process from trauma. Now, today is going to be more introductory, and we're going to just share a couple of ideas and then break it all down in the coming weeks. But the discussion and the awareness of trauma is an important one, right? It's a really important topic, and for many reasons, but partly because it actually goes to the source of many, many conditions, or many, many problems, right? Because often dysfunction, when there's dysfunction, any type of dysfunction, it often looks like one thing, but really, if you go dig deeper, it's an outcome of something deeper, of something stronger, and something perhaps that happened a long time ago, right? Which is all true, and that's why it's important to understand. So many areas of dysfunction, like addiction, anxiety, depression, relationship issues even, disproportionate responses to various triggers. So you sometimes have people that the craziest random thing just sets them off into sort of disproportionate responses of anger or resentment or jealousy or whatever the case is. So all of these areas of dysfunction can, and the emphasis is on can, as we'll see later, it's not always, can be coming from a previous trauma experience, right? Which can be like a trigger. And therefore, dealing with a condition is not enough. It's like dealing with the symptom of a headache and ignoring the cause, the root cause of the sickness, right? That's why sometimes treatment of some conditions are not effective. They're not effective because they're not dealing with the real issue. They're dealing with it maybe temporarily and they're calming it down, but they're not actually dealing with the actual issue. And that's why this discovery or this research on trauma is an important one, because it does go to the root sometimes of the underlying issue and makes it, and it deals with it, not just identifies it, but it needs to be identified so that the healing process can actually be effective, can actually begin. Now, this is a relatively, interestingly enough, there's a relatively new discussion in the psychological literature, coming more like from the 60s onwards kind of thing. One wasn't properly recognized till more recently. There's parts of trauma called complex trauma, which we'll talk about later, which was only recognized as an official sort of condition in the 80s, right? But it is an amazing field, and it's amazing research that has been done by the experts in the field of trauma and the effects of trauma, which is PTSD, like post-traumatic stress disorder, and so on. Now, this approach, of course, of identifying and identifying the root cause of things is a very, it's a very important approach. We find this in many different areas in Jewish literature very often. I mentioned previously the Jewish saying, Yediata makah chatzi refuah, knowing the disease, the diagnosis of the disease is half the cure. Often that's probably true in all medicine. We have, spiritually speaking, we have a lot of discussion in Jewish literature about when person behaves inappropriately and does things that they shouldn't do, looking at the causes. For example, looking at why a person gets angry and looking at perhaps the arrogance or the ego that is behind that, right? So in Hasidic philosophy, in Kabbalistic philosophy, we've talked about this many times, of the seven sort of layers of emotion, but then the ego issues which are behind those seven emotions, which sometimes create the cause of why those emotions are acting in a dysfunctional way. So that concept is an important concept, going understanding on all levels the root of what is happening, the cause of what is happening. We find on a national level, you know, we talk about, it's the wrong time of the year for this, but we talk about Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which commemorates the destruction of the temple. And in Jewish practice, the destruction of the temple creates that saddest day of the year called Tisha B'Av. And it starts with the 17th of Tammuz, which is a fast day, which is a day that the enemies breached the walls of Jerusalem, which led to the destruction. And we find a very interesting thing, which of course was the whole destruction of the temple was, you could call that, I suppose, national trauma. But we find in the literature that they say that when you fast on the day of the 17th of Tammuz, or you commemorate that day as a day of destruction, we don't only focus on the destruction of the temple, we focus on relatively sort of less or minor things that happened on that day. Going back to the time, for example, that Moses broke the tablets, which also happened on the 17th of Tammuz. Now, why is that relevant? Is because the commentaries explain that the reason why you need to do that is because actually the problems that led to, I'm not going to go into it today, that's perhaps for a good discussion before Tisha B'Av, but I just want to highlight that the problems that led to the destruction of the temple started with the problems that brought about the breaking of the tablets that Moses broke after the golden calf. So in other words, why that's relevant is because you can't just look at something something significant or something cataclysmic or something really, really bad that happened. You have to look at what brought it. And you have to go back to that foundation to see how that can be addressed and to see how that can be corrected by going back to the cause. And that's a very similar approach sort of with this idea of exploring the issue of trauma, which often becomes the foundation, or the traumatic experience becomes the foundation of the dysfunction or the condition or the problems that we're experiencing now. Now, I know I've said this 100 times, but I always like to give this disclaimer. I'm not a therapist or a psychologist. I like the concepts, right? So I'm hoping that I will share what I'm going to share with you just as an introduction, because I think it's important. Some of you might be more or less familiar of the aspects of trauma and what it all means. So I'm going to share with you some ideas. If there's any therapists in the room and I get it wrong, please let me know. But I hope it's accurate. I think it's accurate. What I've done, because it's just important to understand a bit of introduction and understand what it's all about, which I've taken from, I mean, it's a very broad and complex topic, but I've taken it from a couple of different experts, just to give you just a few so you understand what we're basing it on. Is there's a very famous book on trauma written by a guy called Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps Score. There's a very popular guy who is now very, very popular, I'm sure so many of you know his name, called Gabor Mate. He just wrote a new book called The Myth of Normal. And then there's one called, a recent book, which I've just, very, very interesting, and it's very relevant to the topic, which we're not going to mention him today so much, but a little bit later, it's called George Bonanno. He's a head of the trauma and very high-level professor in the Columbia University, and he actually wrote a book called The End of Trauma, which we'll get to. I will share with you this interesting thing, just with Gabor Mate. You will see some of the stuff, obviously, I don't agree with, but that's not what I want to share with you. I actually had a dilemma with his stuff, because someone alerted to me, and it's very public on YouTube, so it's not a problem for me to say it, that he's actually very anti-Israel. Did you know that? Extremely anti-Israel, in a very, very strong way. He's in the groups of like Noam Chomsky and Finkelstein and these guys, right? Now, the truth is, I just want to share this is completely not on the topic, but it's just an interesting thought process. Actually, just because he is anti-Israel and he's got terrible views on Israel, that actually itself didn't prevent me from reading his stuff. Because I think sometimes if someone is talking about a topic that's nothing to do with the issue at hand, there's a saying in the Talmud, Kabbalah ta'emet misha omroi. You just have to learn from someone. If they're talking about a topic that's worth learning, you can learn from them. In other words, I don't think that's specifically an issue. What it did do for me, however, was because I saw some of his stuff in Israel. I just wanted to check it out for myself. And like the people in that camp often do, is they cite facts which just are not true, are simply not true. I mean, historically, completely inaccurate. Which strengthened me a little bit because I'm completely certain, and I've spoken to other experts in the field, that a lot of the stuff he says on trauma is also inaccurate, which he bases on facts. But that's fine, because obviously he's not always accurate with these facts. So the part actually that he's anti-Israel was a good thing for me. It's not a good thing, God forbid, but I mean, I'm not so scared to argue with him, even though he's been such an unbelievable expert. Having said that, he says some amazing things, he's done some amazing research, and he certainly, some of his stuff is really good. The second book, the myth of normal or something, thick book, got a lot of time to read it. Okay, so as I said, and then of course we're going to draw on various Jewish topics and Jewish sources and bring it all together. So as an introduction, and obviously this is going to be much more brief. What is trauma? Let's just define it. By the way, the definition of trauma actually is still under debate, but in a general sense, what is trauma? So I want to share with you, just to sort of put it into a bit of an organized fashion, that I think there are three kinds of trauma, right? Now, that's actually not true. There's two kinds of trauma, and you'll see why I said three in a minute. So the two that they talk about is like this. The first is major trauma, or like what Gabor Mate calls trauma with a big T. It's a single event, right? It can be a single event that happened in a person's life that was either very damaging or very frightening and completely out of the ordinary. Right? For example, it could be an experience that a soldier has at war. I'm mentioning that because a lot of the studies, a lot of the research on trauma was actually done with veterans. Besser van der Kolk actually started his journey on understanding trauma by dealing with veterans from Vietnam. Just to give you a little sense, I'm not going to go through the whole chapter, but just a little sense of what he was. I'll just read you some of what he starts with his first chapter. He said, it was Tuesday after the 4th of July weekend, 1978. It was my first day as a staff psychiatrist in the Boston Veterans Administration Clinic. As I was hanging a reproduction of my favorite painting that says, "The Blind Lead the Blind," on the wall of my new office, I heard a commotion in the reception area down the hall. A moment later, a large, disheveled man in a stained three-piece suit carrying a copy of Soldier of Fortune magazine under his arm burst through my door. He was so agitated and so clearly hungover that I wondered how I could possibly help this hulking man. I asked him to take a seat, and I asked him what I could do for him. So he goes on to explain that his name was Tom. 10 years earlier, he'd been in the Marines in Vietnam. Later on the chapter, he describes horrific things that he saw there. And he was drunk because he had just spent the 4th of July weekend with his in his downtown Boston law office, drinking and looking at old photographs rather than with his family. Why? Because he knew from previous years' experience that the noise and the fireworks, the heat and the picnic in his sister's backyard against the backdrop of dense early summer foliage, all of which reminded him of Vietnam, would drive him crazy. So he escaped what would be a PTSD experience and instead went to his office, but didn't really help because he went to alcohol instead, as we'll soon talk about why that happens. So a soldier in Vietnam, a soldier in an army, soldier in combat, witnessing really, really terrible stuff, that's trauma. A person who has a huge accident, for example, which sends a person into tremendous injury with a tremendous impact, that often is real trauma. And you know when something's trauma, when it has the effects of trauma later on, right? Sexual violence, things like sexual abuse of any kind, or violent domestic abuse, things like that, of course, is trauma. Loss of a loved one in not normal circumstances. I'm not talking about end of life, which is always sad, but not traumatic necessarily in that sense, in the true traumatic sense, but losing a loved one in a very, very abnormal and tragic circumstance. So those are all things that we call trauma, the big trauma, the single events that can happen at any time of life and can have long-lasting effects. But then later on, they discovered what they call now complex trauma. And complex trauma essentially is, and that's where the effects of complex trauma was only properly recognized in the early 80s, are much, much smaller traumatic events. In other words, events that if they just happened one time or a few times, they actually wouldn't be traumatic. But because they happened over time, and particularly with children, between the ages of birth and 15, and they happen over a long time and they happen repeatedly, they become a form of trauma which has the similar effects to regular trauma. Right? So in other words, big trauma is when it's a one event, or it could be a one event, but it's so traumatic so it has the trauma effect for many years later. Whereas complex trauma are events that are not that traumatic enough to have that long-lasting effect, but because they happen when a person is young and they happen over time, repeatedly, they become what they call complex trauma, and it becomes similar to regular trauma. Right? Does that make sense? Good, okay. Now, what type of things? Things like neglect, dysfunctional homes where there's a lot of neglect, and things like a big one that's talked about in the literature of trauma is detachment and separation. There's a lot of research on that now. Interesting, Gabor Mate in his work talks about his own trauma, which happened really as a baby. He was a Holocaust survivor, baby Holocaust survivor, who was separated from his parents for 2 years, right? Taken away. Hard to make sense of as he grew older, and of course it did become a source of trauma and a source of a lot of the other issues that he experienced in his life. Growing up in an environment of extreme anger, a toxic sort of environment, or growing up in an environment where you're constantly humiliated, like humiliation, right? These are examples of things that can happen as a child that become what they call today complex trauma. Now, I'll just share with you a couple of, I was reflecting on some Torah sources, Jewish sources for these ideas of trauma. So it's interesting that I heard from a great leading expert in trauma, actually, a religious guy in the States. He gave a talk and he talked about national trauma. It was an interesting perspective, actually. But I'll just share it with you because it's an interesting idea. He talked about what he calls national trauma, but that happened not to the Jewish people when they left Egypt, but to everyone else. So as you know, when the Jewish people left Egypt, they had gone through a long period of persecution. They arrived at the Red Sea and they got trapped. Pharaoh was pursuing them and there was no way out. And of course, there was the miracle of the Red Sea. The middle of the Red Sea involved them, the sea splitting, them going through the sea, and then the sea closing on Pharaoh and his army, and them drowning, of course. Which, of course, brought a lot of relief to the Jewish people, knowing that they were now safe from the enemy. However, there's a passage in the Torah, very interesting, which for some reason the Torah found it important to talk about that although it was an event that had to happen, meaning Pharaoh had sent the Jewish people away, but then insisted on changing his mind and pursuing them. So the punishment that befell him and the nation had to happen, but yet it had a very interesting effect on the neighboring nations. And that's something actually that is part of our prayers every day. We sing the Shirah, the song of that the Jews, Az Yashir, that the Jews sang in thanks to God for saving him in this miracle. And it's a description of the miracle. And over there it says, Tipol aleihem eima vafachad. They're describing the effects that it had on the neighboring nations. And it says that what happened was that it was such, for them, it was a traumatic experience. Imagine being living next to an environment where suddenly a whole nation or whole army drowns in the sea, right? And what fell over them was eima and fachad, which are both translated as fear. But those two words, eima and fachad, are different types of fear. And it's an interesting thing how this works, right? Because when we're scared of something, it can be done in different ways. There's a type of fear, which is what eima is, when you're kind of not near, you're not close to the situation. It's a fear that we have which is much more of an intellectual fear, right? People are worried about things, worried about something happening in America. I mean, you know, conceptually it could happen here, but it's not a fear that you actually are panicked. You're not walking around scared. So it's more sort of an intellectual fear because you're distant from the context, right? Pachad is fear, like panic fear, emotional fear. So there's a midrash that says, why does the Torah say that when the Jews drowned, when the Pharaoh and the Egyptians drowned in the Red Sea, the effect on the neighboring nations was Eima and Fachad? So the midrash says, because it depends which nation it was, those that were far, those that were close. Those that were far heard about this amazing story. Intellectually, they were scared for themselves as well. But the neighboring nations, Pachad, they actually were gripped by fear, because it was that close to the incident that became part of their experience and therefore had that traumatic effect on them, and they were smitten by the concept of pachad, of fear. I'm just giving an example of sort of like an event that can sort of generate that kind of effect. But with regard to what we called before the complex trauma, which is actually more common in a way, so we find some interesting things, right? One of the things they talk about in the research is the effect on children who grow up with humiliation. So we know that humiliation in Jewish sources is a terrible, terrible thing. The Talmud tells us that Hamalbin pnei chaviro berabim, if someone publicly shames or humiliates another person, it's considered, by Talmudic standards, it's considered equivalent to murder, which is a very, very powerful statement. Now, can you imagine, particularly if that's done repeatedly, right? And sometimes children do. They grow up in an environment where that happens. Because murder is the physical murder of someone, but when you humiliate someone publicly, you're assassinating their character, their soul, their emotions, right? So it's interesting that that effect is so clearly stated in the Talmud. In terms of growing up like in an environment of anger, there's a fascinating piece of the Talmud which says, Tukfa b'bitav, someone creates anger, instills anger or fear in his household, that has a long-lasting effect on the members of the household. So you have that sort of quite clearly laid out, that's how it happens. Very interesting, I recently spoke to a distant relative of mine who's an older person, and she had a really sad story, although it turned into a really good story, which is relevant to the later discussions we're going to have. As a child, she went to school, and there was a particular... Now, this is not a school-bashing thing at all. There are wonderful educators, mostly wonderful educators, and wonderful teachers, and so on. But once in a while, you know, it's a quite a dangerous profession. If you don't treat children right, it's a big problem. This is true for parents too, right? So she went to school. Her other siblings had problems in school before. So there was one teacher, almost like an administrator, who just took a dislike to her from day one and really repeatedly was not nice to her, right? And then did something really not nice at the end of primary school. He prevented her getting to a different high school. It was like a really bad thing. And she described how it really affected her, how it really affected her character, her image, her self-image, her self-esteem, and really damaged her permanently. The good part of the story is that she took hold of it and she healed and she became an amazing person, probably from the trauma experience. But, and that can happen. We'll talk about that. But it is certainly true that things that happen, experiences that happen, particularly with younger children, can have a long-lasting effect. Now, those are the two traumas that they talk about. So why did I say there were three traumas? Because I think it's important to mention the following. You know, decades ago, trauma was a very harsh word. Trauma, you say trauma, like, you know, like you always conjured up. Trauma means like something absolutely terrible, right? It was always part of the English language, but it had that sort of connotation of being something very, very bad. Now, but it wasn't understood and it wasn't talked about. When you raise awareness of something, which is a good thing, it's always a good thing to raise awareness and to understand things that are real, but it always comes with a cost. And this is true in lots of areas, right? Mental health awareness, all these things, they're critical, they must happen, they're important, but you also have to look out for the cost that they come with. And the cost that they come with is that the term, people become very comfortable with the term, and it becomes very used, and then it becomes blurry. And people use and abuse the term and apply it in ways where it's not meant to be applied, right? And I say that with trauma because now trauma is a word that everyone says. I was traumatized. Okay. So, I mean, sometimes people just say I was traumatized. They mean that, like, figuratively speaking. But sometimes it gets used more seriously because we live, as you've heard me say many times, we live in a very fragile world now, right? So, the third trauma I was going to talk about to be aware of, which isn't really trauma, it's just regular stress. These are not even my words. This is the word that Besser van der Kolk says himself. He says, the difference between stress and trauma is this. Stress happens all the time. He says a lot of life isn't good. It just happens, right? But when the stress is over, it's over. Trauma is when the body keeps score, as his book title is, when there's long-lasting effects on many, many different levels, right? And I say that because not everything is trauma. We have to be very aware that as we raise the awareness of trauma, and as we seek help for perhaps traumatic experience that we might have had, which might be real, and we seek therapy, or we seek help for it, or we go through the healing process, it also needs to be understood that not everything is trauma. So, for example, today in the world of therapy, it's quite common. You know, no one's parents are perfect, right? I didn't have perfect parents. You didn't have perfect parents. I wasn't the perfect parents. And when you aren't either. And your kids who complain about your parenting. Sorry? No, that's the point, right? That's the point. But nowadays, there's like a very quick excuse for trauma. I'm traumatized, or I'm going through so much because of my parents' imperfections. And I know firsthand stories of people that I've counseled that I'm telling you that it wasn't trauma. And I'm not a therapist, and I'm always very scared to diagnose. But I can tell you, I can diagnose this one. It wasn't trauma, okay? It just wasn't trauma. Just a bunch of imperfect parents. Functional home, loving parents, meals on time, laundry done, school paid for. Okay, so they didn't always, they sometimes lost their temper. Big deal, right? Tried hardest. We all make mistakes. So I'm just giving you as an example, right? A kid that grows up in a completely dysfunctional home, real dysfunction, that could be trauma. That's complex trauma. Or a kid that grows up with a very harsh parent who continuously put them down, maybe. But a regular parent where, where now in reflection, they didn't give me enough time, or they weren't there for me always, or all that kind of stuff, that's just not trauma, although often it is called trauma. And it's not trauma. People have to be aware of that. So it's very important to be, it's like part of life, That's it. It's life. It's called life. Or a teacher. I mean, I heard, I do some consulting for some schools, and then there was a teacher having a problem with a particular parent who used the word trauma like over and over again because the kid, little kid, like 8 years old or something, had a rough year with the teacher. The teacher was a little strict. Now, I know the teacher was not overly strict and wasn't humiliating to the kids and was actually a very warm, beautiful teacher. But, I think it's a teacher's right to put in some boundaries into the classroom. You just couldn't do what you want, You have to follow instructors even when you think they're not correct. That's just part of growing up. And the teacher might be wrong, and that's true. The teacher does not traumatize this kid. Absolutely not. And this parent really believes, honestly believes, that, and said it in emails and actually says it, that my child was traumatized from the experience and really has a hard time now from going into the next year, and it's going to affect the next year. Get over it. Like, unless your child has other psychological problems, which is possible. Trauma's not the only one. I mean, there could be other issues that need to be looked at, and maybe the child needs support for other personality disorders or other issues that the child might have intrinsically, but it's not trauma. And we need to be very aware of that, because we are running into a process where we start calling everything trauma, and it's just a real escape, and it's a shift of responsibility. And also what it is, and I feel very strongly about this, when words are used very simply, and it's true in lots of areas of life, when people call trauma, call experiences trauma when they're not trauma, it actually undermines and disrespects the people who really experience trauma. And I think that's very, very important, right? We know that we always talk about that, like when, people make comparisons to the Holocaust or Hitler or something like that, and we say really disrespectful for real victims. That's true. That's 100% true. But the same thing in every area of life. When you simplify a word, right? When you simplify a word like that, it disrespects those who are going through the true meaning of the word, and that's a problem. So that was the third trauma. That's why I said there's not really three traumas, but it's not trauma, it's just real life. We have to be aware of it, that we shouldn't fall into that trap of everything becoming trauma. Is it getting a bit warm in here?
No.
It is. No? You're good? Okay. No problem. All right. Now, we need to understand, again, I said today would be introductory because it's really important to understand the context before we get into break it down, the real issues. I'm sorry?
Divorce, like a separation.
Oh, divorce for children, you mean?
Divorce.
Yeah, well, divorce can be a traumatic experience for sure. But actually, the literature says divorce can be particularly traumatic for children, particularly if it's a messy one. And it's ongoing and the conflict is ongoing. If it's not managed, unfortunately, not managed properly, as often it isn't. It can be for very young children, very traumatic. Because it's true that children do need to, Children have a need to be to have a connection, as we'll talk about maybe next week in greater depth. Therefore, also children have a need to be safe, right? And sorry? I think it can be. I think it depends on the person and what the context was and what the journey. I'm not expert enough to really comment on that. Okay, so let's just talk about. Okay, so that's what trauma is. Now let's talk about the effects of trauma. Okay. We good? Okay, let's talk about the effects of trauma. So the effects of trauma is the following. First of all, when we talk about the significant trauma, not always, and I emphasize not always, we're going to look at some fascinating research in the coming weeks about that. Trauma sometimes, not always, but sometimes results in a condition they call PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder. And insignificant trauma that often happens in the following. It can be flashbacks, nightmares, panic attacks, lack of sleep, real fear, panic, all that kind of stuff, real anxiety, real depression sometimes, right? So depression sometimes isn't depression, not always, but sometimes it's not depression on its own, it's really a symptom of previous trauma, significant trauma, right? I mean, there's a lot of stories in these books, if you read them, about people who really went through horrific things, like horrific accidents, and then couldn't sleep, but they kept on having flashbacks of the truck and coming into them, or these nightmares, and they go into real panic and the real fear. An alternative expression of PTSD is not all these things, but actually it's what they call numbing, that people just become numb. Because they have to block out the experience, they become numb. So in other words, in order to block out the experience, they have to numb their emotions. The problem is emotions are not like a stove that you can put on and off when you want, right? If you numb your emotions, they become numb. And that's what they call depersonalization. So the person then becomes like not a person. They've lost themselves. They're a shell of a human being. Have you heard that expression? The person becomes a shell of a human being. I mean, that can happen with old age, very old age sometimes. But it can also happen just from trauma. Because just Holocaust survivors sometimes, exactly, right? That's sometimes that's how they deal with it. Meaning, they might even be functional, but they're just emotionally deficient because they've numbed, right? Victims of it often happens with victims of sexual abuse. That sometimes happens, where they just become numb. That's why we find often that they lose memory. Has to do with that as well. They don't have memory because they've just blocked it all out, so they become very numb, right? So that's part of the PTSD that happens with real trauma. But in terms of the complex trauma, which is those little incidents that happen over time, they can manifest themselves. The PTSD can manifest itself in many, many different ways. It can be feeling of insecurity where nothing is safe. So a child was always humiliated. A child grew up in a very unsafe environment or a detached environment. They become like nothing is safe. They're very skeptical. They're very suspicious always, right? Like trouble sleep. Sometimes in certain areas of trauma, there's manifests itself of like not being able to connect to people, not being able to be touched, a fear of being touched and so on, right? A very common symptom of complex trauma is very bad self-image, very, very, very negative self-esteem. That's sometimes, not always it comes from trauma, but it does often come from trauma. An ongoing feeling of guilt and shame, like I'm not worthy enough, and if everything I do is no good, and I feel guilty, and I feel shame, I feel embarrassed always. Difficulty of connection. It's interesting research I read that sometimes people with complex trauma, PTSD, are the people that always go for the people that, like they don't connect to people that connect to you. They always go, they'll go into a room, they'll make they'll always spot the people that are like, don't connect to others. So that it's a safe relationship, right? Other people in the country, you get attracted to people who do connect. Like you'll have to talk to someone, will connect to you, and right away there'll be a connection, have a conversation, and you know, that kind of thing, right? But they will pick up the people who don't connect well because they don't want to connect themselves, which is a problem, of course, because connection is a very important thing, right? Sorry? Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, yeah. Paranoia is often a symptom of complex trauma, and so on and so forth. Now, often, as I said, other conditions like depression, anxiety, substance addiction, very, very fascinating stuff. So there's many reasons why people become addicted, right? But often what substance addiction is, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's pornography, whatever it is, right? Addiction is addiction. Addiction is a real illness. But sometimes it's not the illness itself, and that's often missed, and it's a problem. In the treatment of addiction, this is something that's, they all talk about it, something that's often missed, and therefore it's missed and not dealt with properly. Because an amazing thing they talk about, and I want to share this with you, it's quite an amazing thing. Why that happens is because people who went through traumatic experience or went through complex trauma are often in great pain. And they need to find a place where they have pleasure versus pain, right? And often, therefore, they fall into addictions, because when they are involved in that substance that they're or that experience they're addicted to, it becomes a place where they're comfortable. They know in their mind that it's very bad for them, but right now they're okay. And it numbs the pain, right? And therefore, there's this line they talk about it. They say, when you treat, sometimes you treat addiction, addiction is not the problem. For the addict, addiction was the solution, not the problem. And therefore, when you treat just the addiction, you're not treating the problem. You're treating what was for them the solution. You need to treat the problem. The problem is the pain that came before the addiction, right? Which is a fascinating idea. So that's the effect of trauma, one of the effects of trauma. The other effect of trauma, of course, is what it does to the physical body. So they all talk about Gabor Mate, the Besser von der Kolk, all these people talk about, and they complain about the modern medical world that fails sometimes to acknowledge that body, emotion, mind all work together, and they all really affect each other. Now, of course, in Judaism, that's an old concept. On a spiritual level, it's an old concept. We know that the body and the soul affect each other. We are taught that a small hole in the body creates a big hole in the soul. The Rambam, Maimonides, talks about living healthily becomes part of serving Hashem, because you actually can't serve God properly unless you're physically healthy as well, and so on and so forth. We sometimes talk about spiritual deficiencies expressing themselves in physical deficiencies and so on and so forth. But it's an amazing thing that how it affects the body. Now, it affects the body in two ways. Two things happen. The first, I'm going to be very brief for two reasons. First of all, I don't want to take a long time explaining it. Second of all, it's very scientific, and I failed biology in school. So I'll just... I can never remember the names. It was a nightmare. I have this, like, maybe that was a traumatic experience of mine. The third type of trauma. Okay, but I've always had a version. But I was reading it slowly. My wife was laughing at me because I was reading this. I was reading this chapter, which explains, and I was very fascinated by it. But I can't read this stuff fast. And I was making some notes. And she's an avid reader. She says to me, "Are you reading or are you studying?" So the brain has different parts, right? So I might get this completely wrong, but I thought it was fascinating. I'll share it with you very quickly. There's a part of the brain called the amygdala. There's a part called the frontal cortex, and there's a thing they call the thalamus. So the amygdala is that part of the brain that what they call is like a smoke detector, right? So you know how we have this fight-flight response to stress, right? To a dangerous situation. Or freeze, by the way. That's another option that people do. So when there's a dangerous situation, something coming at us, the smoke detector goes off and we either fight or we flee or we freeze, right? Those are responses to very stressful or frightening situations. So that's what what regulates that is the amygdala, right? That goes off, the smoke detector goes off, and we respond. However we respond to stress, then that's when we respond. But then we have the prefrontal cortex, which actually is like a watchtower.
Isn't that the reptilian brain?
Yeah, something like that. But don't make it more complicated for me than it is, please.
Well, it is, because it's a...
I'm trying to sound like I know what I'm talking about.
The reptilian brain is the part that fear flight. That's what we started with.
Yeah, okay. We actually started the whole thing, by the way, because God created the whole man. But that's a separate discussion. Right? We actually didn't come from monkeys, by the way. Yeah. I heard a good little story, by the way. I heard about a couple that he believed in God and creationism, and she believed in evolution. The kid comes and asks his father, "Where do we come from?" So he starts telling him about his ancestors, and this one, you know, my Zayda was a big rabbi, this one was a big kind man. And a couple of days later, the kid comes back to the father and says, "Daddy, daddy, I've got a problem. I asked mommy the same question, and she said, we come from monkeys." So the father said, "No, that's her side of the family." Okay. All right. Anyway, we'll leave another time to talk about that. But anyway, but yes, that's great. Now the prefrontal cortex is like a watchtower, because what happens is it's like there's different kinds of stressful situations, right? So the watchtower sort of watches, like, what's the information coming through? Is it really a frightening situation, or is it not a frightening situation, right? So the smoke detector won't go off if, you know, someone walks through the room that you know, or someone says something pretty normal, right? It's not stressful, it's not a frightening situation. So the prefrontal cortex will sift that out. So therefore, the smoke it won't let it come in. So the fire won't come in. It's like at home, there's a little fire in a stove, but it's not enough to set up the smoke detector, right? So that's what the prefrontal cortex does. And the other parts of the brain that deal with sensory stuff that sift out what does come in, what doesn't come in. What happens with people that experience trauma, which is very fascinating, I probably didn't get this 100% right, you can check out the book. But what is interesting is that all this starts to malfunction when you experience trauma, right? So that's why we have this concept called triggers, because the prefrontal cortex doesn't sift out the proper information. So someone can say something, and to the person who went out trauma, the smoke detector goes off. And that's why sometimes people go into this panic or go into this PTSD experience because they're imagining a frightening situation, because someone said something and it set off a memory, and therefore they're reliving the trauma, and therefore the response to stress, the fight, the flight, or the freeze goes off again and doesn't work properly, right? So that's kind of the and actually becomes a physical thing. But besides that, that's why I say it changes the brain, how the brain functions, and we have to heal that, right? The other thing is that physical illness often comes from trauma. And this is a lot of research that's been done. Gabor Mate talks about it a lot. He believes in it in extreme. And he traces many different illnesses to actually trauma experiences, and therefore talks about that the therapy for illness obviously is medical intervention, but also has to sometimes come together with therapeutic intervention, healing the trauma. Okay, so that's simplified trauma in a nutshell, in a sort of a simplified way. But of course, the question is really, okay, that's nice, so that's trauma, but what do we do with it, right? So how do we become aware of it? What do we do with it? How do we heal? How trapped do we need to be in our trauma? And are we always trapped in that trauma? In other words, will trauma have the same effect on other people? Can we prevent it, right? When I say can we prevent it, I don't mean can we prevent trauma, because we can't. Trauma comes from the outside. I mean, can we prevent the effects of trauma, right? And so on, which is all questions that we're going to break down and go into a great length, or somewhat detail in the coming weeks. But what I wanted to do for the remaining time that we have is just share with you some introductory sort of comments. You know, there's a line in Kabbalistic writings, you know, how the world started with Adam and Eve, and then they did the first transgression, they ate from the tree of knowledge, which Kabbalistically introduced into the world a very complex energy of purity and impurity, all mixed together. So there's a saying that since the time that Adam and Eve ate from the tree, en tov below rava en ra below tov. There's no good without bad, there's no bad without good. It's all mixed up together. Why do I say that? Because I go back to what I said before. When some good thing is highlighted, and again, it is a good thing that the study in trauma is being highlighted, but it always comes with that danger that it's going to be, as I said before, used or abused in the wrong way, right? I want to just highlight some of those dangers because I think it's important to be aware of them, particularly from a Jewish perspective and how we deal with some of these things from a Jewish perspective with the Torah view. One danger is the following. Often, and I find this with lots of things throughout the different things that have popped up in the different sort of decades, right? When something becomes the topic of the day, there's a tendency that it becomes the only thing. Have you noticed that ever? This is it. This is the answer to every problem, right? That's a fundamental mistake, because when you have a discussion on something like trauma, and it will be a highlighted and detailed discussion because it is being, it's a live thing at the moment. It's still being researched, it's still being understood, it's still being developed, right? But just like you claim in the discussion that you have to have the discussion with body, soul, and mind all together, you also have to have the discussion holistically in a different way. You need to understand that there's many, many parts to a human experience. There's many parts to a human personality. There's many parts to a human makeup, particularly from a Jewish point of view in terms of the spiritual makeup of the person, right? So what I mean by this, so a couple of ideas. First of all, we need to understand there is never, ever only one answer to a problem, right? Gabor Mate says that every person that's an addict is because of trauma. Now, that's simply not true. And I checked this with a very leading person yesterday, because I don't want to stand up and just say it's not true when he's the researcher, right? But I know that it's not true from a Jewish perspective. It's definitely not true. It also has a very big, when you say that, it has a very big danger, and this is the danger we need to be aware of in the discussion of trauma, while we continue to highlight it and become aware of it, is that you don't want to create something where you have something to blame, because that's where the world is heading in general. We like to blame everything on something. If it's not my parents, then it's my trauma. If it's not my trauma, it's my friend, it's my teacher, it's this, that, and the other, right? So we have to be very careful with that, because as human beings, we have to work hard. To make life work, we have to put in a lot of effort. Even when there's trauma, we'll talk about this next week, we have to be ready to put in the hard work to heal. Healing doesn't come easy, of course, right? So, and also, so what I mean, that there's many reasons for something. We know that we are not born perfect, which, by the way, is news to some nowadays, because, I'm serious, because there's a tendency, this is why it's like it says, it's become a whole trend in today's society, that you have to accept me, the whole of me, every part of me, the way I am is fine. I've got news for you, the way you are is not fine, right? Because you weren't born and I've got to unconditionally accept you, I've got to accept you the way you are, I'm not allowed to judge you, that's all true. But are you perfect? No, you're not perfect. And that's an estimated guess. No one in this room is perfect. Anyone who wants to challenge me on that, let's go. But, right? I'm not perfect, you're not perfect, no one's perfect. Why? Because fundamentally, and this is so fundamental to Jewish thinking, we are all born imperfect, which means we are born, as we've talked about before, with a godly soul and an animal soul. A godly soul is the part that inspires meaning, inspires purpose, inspires selflessness, inspires giving, and so on and so forth. The animal soul is exactly the way it sounds. It's an animal soul. It's a source of our ego. It's a source of our deficiency. It's a source of many weaknesses that we have. In fact, in the book of Tanya, we've mentioned this before, the Alter Rebbe, the author of the seminal work of Chabad Hasidus, talks about the animal soul being the one based on ego, and Klipa, as he calls it, the impurity. And he says, just like the physical world is made up of four foundations, fire, water, fire, dust, water, and wind, so too the spiritual makeup of the soul. And each one brings with it different weaknesses. So for example, fire brings arrogance and sort of overinflated sense of self. Dust brings laziness. Fire can bring anger. Water brings overindulgence, lust, temptation. We don't have time now to go into why that all is, but that's what we all, we all have a dominant weakness, or weaknesses, right? And some people are born with addictive personalities, got nothing to do with trauma. I know people that have gone through addiction and healed very well. I saw a YouTube where he complains about the 12-step program. Now, the 12-step program is a very, again, first of all, there's no program that's good for everyone. Everyone has different journeys of healing. But the 12-step program is an amazing program. It's healed and helped millions and billions of people, right? With very good values. His complaint is that they don't talk about trauma. Okay, they don't. Maybe they should, but they don't. Okay, but it's also a mistake to think that everyone who's an addict has had trauma. Now, trauma can inspire addiction. It's true. But addiction can also come because a person was born with an addictive personality and he grows up in a community or a thing where there's a strong alcohol party culture, and it's available, and tried it when he was 7 or 8, and then 11 and 12, and became addicted. That is very simple, as simple as that. You want to ask me? Right? So there's no one cause for everything. So while trauma is a cause for lots of things, and we need to understand it, it's certainly not the cause of everything. There are certain things, are life challenges, right? Certain people just can't stop indulging. Certain people are just jealous people. That's their personality deficiency. That's what God gave them to work on. God gave us each a set of things which we don't like, and we need to just work on it. And that's what life is about. That's what life is. There are many people who are born and grew up with no trauma, no significant trauma at least, functional homes with, yes, a little bit imperfect parents, but they're protected and fed and taken care of physically and spiritually, imaging fine, and they have struggles, because we all have struggles. Because that's how we're born. We have an animal soul. We're not born only with a godly soul. We're born with an animal soul as well. To give us the pathway to work on. Each person has to become better by working on these weaknesses. Let me just finish. Also, people have more than one need. So I'll give you just another important thing to be aware of. And this is important, and I'm just saying as an introduction, as we go through the different areas of prevention and healing, right? So I saw a suggestion in the literature, part of it comes from detachment, children's detachment from parents, and there's enough evidence today to actually back that up. Particularly when they're first born, it's really important. It's actually quite scary what's going to happen in a few years of the kids who were taken away from their mothers during COVID. But anyway, that's a separate thing. It'll be an interesting study to be done down the track. But it is important. and especially when kids are very, very young, to hold them and to love them and to hug them, it's definitely backed up. However, when you take it to the extreme, and I heard that one of the writers on trauma say, you know, parents need to really hug their children, hold their children, and when you get told that it's okay to let a child cry for a little bit, that's very bad, you should never ever do that. And that is pathetic, I'm sorry. First of all, I was very offended by that because I did that to all my kids. And I think they're pretty okay, most of them. No, you know, when I was studying in Kollel, I was studying before I got married, there was a rabbi, a very good rabbi, who actually happens to be the grandfather of my son-in-law now. I mean, we became a chatanim much later, but he was my rabbi, he's been my rabbi for years, one of my rabbis. And I remember him saying in the marriage class that he gave us, he says he wants to give us a little bit of advice when we have children. He says, when children cry, it's actually healthy for the lungs. I didn't know that he was had a medical background, but I took his advice anyway. Now, no, the real serious part that I wanted to say about with it is, no, but actually there's a real problem with this. Why is there a real problem with that approach? Because, you know, you can never, it's multifaceted. That's why life is very complex, right? And I agree, children, of course, need love. That's one of the needs. But you know what else they need? They need something called frustration tolerance, right? They need to grow up knowing that life doesn't need to be comfortable. And this is the disease of our generation. We need to be perfect. And if I'm not perfect, it's someone else's fault. And we need to be comfortable the whole time. No, that's not true. We're actually not perfect. And we actually need to be uncomfortable sometimes. That is life. Right? And therefore, actually, I would say not only is it not necessary to always pick up a kid every time they cry, it's in fact necessary to sometimes not do it. Because they don't always have to get what they want. And actually, children have to get so much love at the beginning of their life, which is absolutely true. But they also need to get a sense of life comes with discomfort and it's okay. So that's just one thing. And lastly, last point I want to make, and I'll just finish with that because it's getting late, and then we'll go into everything broken down, hopefully in more detail in the coming weeks. One of the things that I fear also that's happening, and I think that's a problem, when we discover new things, we tend very often in our generation to just discard the previous generations and not to look at them and what their experiences were. And that's a very fundamental mistake. You know, oh, they never knew about trauma, they were damaged, you know, if only they would have had therapists and all that kind of stuff. While that's true to some degree, it's also very not true. I'll just share with you, I was thinking about this, and I'll share with you a personal thing. You've always heard me talk about my Zayda, my grandfather, who I was very close to, who was an exceptionally healthy individual. And I mean, I'm talking about healthy, meaning not just physically, he was healthy as a person. He's emotionally healthy. But like in a very emphasized way, he could laugh at himself a little bit. He was very healthy. He could create boundaries we needed to. He was just an extremely healthy person. And I never actually thought about it, but in reading about trauma and the things that bring trauma, I realized that when he was a child, he actually had real trauma, right? He lost his mother to starvation when he was a young child. They were so poor that that's what happened. Back in the shtetl, it happens sometimes, right? His mother literally died from starvation. Losing a parent at a young child is trauma. He grew up, the poverty was terrible. His father remarried. He never spoke about it much, but I kind of got the signal that there wasn't a fantastic love affair there. Between him and his mother. His stepmother, I mean. And he actually ended up leaving home at 15 to go study in yeshiva because he had to leave home, right? A lot of trauma. And you would never tell me, he certainly never complained about it. He always spoke about his hometown in glowing terms. But he wasn't a numb person at all. He was an extremely emotional person, very, very healthy. And I think one of the things we need to do in looking at trauma, we actually have to look at why. So what did he do that we can learn from? What character traits did he have, or people like him, many people like him, that we can learn from in understanding how we prevent or treat trauma? Right? Because something happened. I mean, he had trauma. And if you're going to accept that trauma is a real thing, then we have to look at those people, not just nowadays, in today's context, but we have to look at those people who went through trauma, clearly went through trauma, and yet survived beautifully, or healed beautifully, and became amazing people. So we really need to look at that. And it might be, some of that might...
exception to the rule.
I don't think so. I know many, many people. Like, I was giving an example because it was close to home. But we'll see the research, actually, according to George Bannon in the book called The End of Trauma, is that actually a lot of people survive trauma more than we think. Right? And we have to look at that. And some of that might be looking at some values that they had, believe it or not, which we need to return to today's society. So that might be part of the thing. So we need to really have a look at that. And that will become part of the discussion going forward over the next few weeks. Yes, sorry?
What about genetics?
So yes, I'm getting to the whole thing. So there is genetics, and now there's a whole study on genes of trauma, and intergenerational trauma, and epigenetic trauma, and all that kind of stuff. Also very scientific, but we'll mention it and come to it throughout the weeks. Correct. Now, people are more disposed to that, but we need to know what it is. What are they disposed to? What is it that's doing it so we can learn it? Don't forget, Martin Seligman was the one who said in positive psychology, yes, there are people that are more optimistic than others, but optimism can be learned. So that needs to be looked at. Okay, have a wonderful week. Sorry.
Brilliant.